Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Later in the program, something that we don't often do, which is a segment on military service sports and the Air Force Academy's controversial football decision. But first, joining us now is Sean Warren, the Vice President for Large Combat and Mobility Engines at GE Aviation. Sean, thanks very much for joining us.
No, thanks for having me, Vago.
And I'm very sorry that we're not doing this one-on-one and in person, which is always a treat. Obviously, you know, it's been a very, very busy year, and I want to get your views on how you guys are operating in a corona environment as well. But first, the news. B-52 is going to be re-engined to ensure it remains the backbone of the U.S. bomber force for many years to come. The community is as busy as ever doing deterrence missions all around the world. You guys are offering two engines, the CF-34-10 and the Passport. Power plants, obviously Pratt & Whitney and Rolls, are also in this contest. You've just been certified that your engines are all American. What's that mean? And bring us up to speed on where we are on the program.
Yeah, no, so thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk about B-52, right? So as most know, all of the competitors just turned in our proposals late July timeframe. We turned ours in a couple of days early. You know, the Air Force really did a great job driving a pretty competitive proposal process. They're really forcing all of the competitors to put their best foot forward. You know, as we've talked all along, we had the opportunity to have two great engines that were perfect for the B-52. We had the CF-34-10, you know, 1,600 engines of service, 30 million service flight hours, 99.98% reliability, one of the most reliable engines we've ever had in our portfolio, as well as the best thrust availability on the program. And then you've got the Passport, which is a state-of-the-art engine, brand new technology, best fuel burn in the thrust class. So we were privileged to have two engines to propose. You know, very excited about the opportunity. We feel good about our chances in the competition. The way I look at it is we've got at least a 50% chance since we have two of the four engines being offered. Also excited to announce that both of our engines are going to be built in the U.S., which we held off until now, but the CF-34-10 is actually going to be built at our Durham facility in North Carolina. It's our largest production facility, and Durham actually at some point in time has built one of all of our different commercial variants, CF-6, C-90, GMX, CFMs. They've done CF-34-10s in the past. So a very capable shop, really our go-to shop from an assembly standpoint. So excited to have the CF-34-10 be manufactured there. We've actually got the first production engine coming off the new line at Durham facility right now. And then on a Passport side, we transitioned that from Strother to Lafayette, Indiana, which is actually one of our newest production facilities there. The first production engine is coming off the line as well there. So the programs are continuing to move forward full speed ahead. You know, we're anxious to engage with the Air Force throughout the solicitation process, and hopefully the U.S. Air Force picks the right guys and we continue to work with them on the B-52 program out into the future.
And down select decision is estimated when?
Yeah, I think we've heard ranges from April 1st to July 1st next year. So sometime in the second quarter, we would anticipate a source selection.
The coronavirus pandemic has affected everybody. GE is no exception. In fact, you guys have had sort of a double whammy in the sense that it impacts production programs, but also while defense programs like yours are going well, commercial aviation has been devastated, and GE, of course, is a significant commercial aviation engine supplier. Talk to us about how it's changed how you guys are operating and the lessons you're learning to actually, you know, because almost everybody has been using this as an opportunity to improve their operations. We talk to Pentagon folks all the time who are talking about improving their game through this process. How are you guys changing how you operate in a more lasting way?
Yep. No problem. And really, I think the first thing we come back to is protecting the health and safety of employees. So we've implemented some layers of safety here, and we did it very early on in the corona pandemic process, as we really wanted to try and get out in front of it. So, you know, leveraging some of the recommendations from the CDC and other health organizations, we've been doing temperature checks before employees come in, wearing face coverings, make sure we're maintaining social distancing. We've reduced occupancy in conference rooms, expanded cleaning protocols. And I would say we've been doing this since the early to mid-March timeframe, in the very early days of the coronavirus pandemic, just to make sure we were protecting our employees. We've also had expanded work from home situations and protocols throughout this process here. And I think to the question you asked, it's been very interesting, even working with the government, sort of navigating some of the technology challenges, and I might even call them even opportunities to connect in different ways. I mean, for me personally, I probably spend at least a third of my time, if not more, on the road meeting customers. And I probably took my first business trip last week, and that was the first time I traveled in like 5 months. But you still have to connect with customers. So a lot more Zoom meetings, Teams meetings, video conferences, just connecting kind of more personal one-on-one on cell phones. And so it's really changed, I think, the way we've worked with our customers throughout this process. And in some ways, I would say, it's even gotten us to be closer to each other, right? We spend more time talking about our families and what's going on when we have calls now, given the overall environment and everything going on. So.
Let me ask you about the broader impact and how, you know, like any civil military company, right? The great part is one side counterbalances the other. And ideally, you have both cycles working well, which was the case for a long time where military was rising, but so was the commercial side of the business. That's been impacted. But you have so many programs that are crossover programs. CFM56 is a great engine. You've been building that for decades in partnership with Safran. It's a mainstay of the 737 program, but it's also important for the P-8 Poseidon maritime patrol aircraft, for example. Talk to us a little bit about how the commercial slowdown is impacting you on the defense side and whether it's going to reduce, for example, the amount of investment resources you're going to have to make sure that you guys stay as competitive as you can on the defense side of things.
Yeah. So absolutely great question. And look, it's the commercial engine and services business is clearly a big part of GE Aviation. So we feel the effect just like every other commercial aviation company, just to the statement you made. That being said, throughout the entire process, we've really been trying to look at this as an opportunity to really maximize what we do on the military side of the business. So, you know, for me, I cover kind of the large combat and mobility engine space. And for the most part, as a general rule, our demand has been pretty stable throughout this process here. So even on those CFM engines that you talk about, we did not see a dip in demand, even though the commercial side was hurting, right? So our demand has been stable, and we've been trying to look at this as an opportunity for ways to go do even more to go support our customers. Can we invest more in the military business? And even, you know, in the unfortunate places where we've had to take actions, we've always prioritized protecting the military side of the business so that those effects don't bleed over, because our demand has been stable.
Speaking of demand, you guys, the U.S. Air Force went ahead with the F-15EX program, the latest generation of the venerable F-15 fighter, with a whole series of improvements that really have been reserved mostly for the export market. You guys are the power plant of choice. I think when people think of large engines, they have a tendency of thinking things with large turbofans on them, but you're also in the turbojet business. You and I got into a conversation about the turbojet heritage of the business. Talk to us a little bit about what F-15EX means for you guys and why it's such an important program.
Yeah, so we are extremely excited about the F-15EX program. As you know, over the past several years, Boeing has been very successful selling F-15s in the international market and really leveraging some of the international customers to make some investments in the platform there. We've been fortunate to power all of the F-15s delivered in the last 8 years in that partnership with Boeing. So we are the only engine tested, integrated, and certified on the most recent advanced version of the F-15 program there. We're currently delivering engines for the Qatar Air Force program. Boeing just did a fly-off a couple of months ago for the first Qatari jet. So extremely excited to be supporting the advanced F-15 program, and even more excited to hear that the Air Force is continuing to move forward with the F-15EX program there. As you saw in the press, we were awarded the Lot 1 deliveries there, $101 million contract there. We're actually just wrapping up our deliveries of the first ship set of engines for Lot 1 here. We are active in production and ready to go support the Air Force rapid fielding development need, which is really the argument that they've been making to go put the F-15 purchase out there, given the condition of some of their F-15 Cs and Ds.
And so for the 110 market, what does that mean, right? I mean, how many more ship sets do you anticipate in this program as the production of the jet not only stretches out new orders, but will prompt some folks to come back and say, hey, look, let's re-engine, let's go to a new generation of aircraft through the upgrade market?
No, so it's a great question. Just for F-15EX itself, the first lot was for 19 engines. As you can see in the pre-solicitation notice, the lots 2 through 8 can be up to 461 engines there. So obviously a very sizable program from the U.S. Air Force standpoint. And then I think to the point you made, and we kind of see this for us on the F-15 and F-16 market, there really has been a rebirth of fourth gen fighter jets in the marketplace there. And I tend to call them 4.5 fighter jets because they have so much additional capability than the earlier versions of the jets. We've seen a lot of progress on the F-16 side in the international market. And I think your point is spot on that as the U.S. Air Force moves forward, we would expect some of the existing international F-15 customers to come in and start considering buying jets. You know, we power F-15s in Saudi Arabia, South Korea, and Singapore. Would not shock me if South Korea and Singapore reevaluated if they wanted to go buy some more F-15. And, you know, I think India has talked about maybe considering F-15s now as part of their MMRCA program there if Boeing puts it in. So I think just with all the investments in the platform, there's a lot of opportunity out there for international F-15s.
Sean, always a pleasure having you on. Thanks very much for joining us.
No, thanks for having me, Vaga. Always a pleasure.
And joining us now are three friends and college sport fanatics, all retired United States Navy commanders, who are all also hosts of the Sing Second Sports Weekly podcast on United States Naval Academy sports. Ward Carroll, the host of the United States Naval Institute's Proceedings podcast and a graduate of the fabled Naval Academy class of 1982. John Schofield, former Naval Academy spokesman, and our producer, Chris Cervello, who is a 1999 Academy graduate. John and Chris are also founding partners of the Provision Advisors PR firm. Gentlemen, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Vaga.
Hey, Vaga. Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Vaga.
Absolute pleasure. Ward and John, a special welcome because this is your first outing, although we've known one another for some time. Chris, start us off. What's noteworthy about Service Academy football this year, right? This is the kind of segment that we don't normally do. We get focused on sort of strategy and politics and budgets and not military sports. Full disclosure, I am not the biggest sports fan. Most people know that about me, but I always try to pay attention a little bit to Service Academy sports. What's special in this COVID year?
So first off, Bago, and you were an athlete in college. The reason that we are so into sports, particularly Naval Academy sports, is the significance that athletics plays in the lives of and education of midshipmen and cadets at the service academies. It's one of the three keys at each of those, along with academics, along with the leadership side and ethics side, and then you have athletics. So athletics is very important. And the all three service academies were intent on playing football and trying to get as much of the other sports as they could in during these extraordinary times, particularly Navy and Army, whose two conferences, Army, the Conference USA, and Navy, the American Athletic Conference, their football conferences were having as close to normal season as they could. The Air Force Academy, who is part of the Mountain West Conference, they are only playing Army and Navy and will likely play some version of their conference schedule in the spring. You have what is normally a very important and very bitter but respected rivalry. You have going on with the backdrop of COVID. I would even say that there's a little bit of election spillover that is affecting some of the rivalry. So you have Navy and Air Force squaring off this weekend in Colorado Springs, and then you'll have the West Point will play Navy and Air Force later in the year, and they'll be a winner, and that winner will be the recipient of the Commander in Chief's Trophy. And there are some that would say that this season has an asterisk by it. But for those of us, whether you went to West Point, whether you went to the Air Force Academy, or those of us that went to Navy, know that there is no asterisk when it comes to the Commander in Chief's Trophy. And so that rivalry presses on, and we'll see how it goes.
And what's it like being, because you guys were calling games, you've, Chris, a couple of times sent me pictures for how weird it is being at Navy Marine Corps Stadium and having it empty and a game going on. What's the vibe like, and what can you tell us about what the Army-Navy game is going to look like? Obviously, it alternates between Philadelphia and Baltimore, and what the regs, and right, because by now we would have all bought our tickets.
Yeah, I'm not sure we know. So to start with your second question first, I'm not sure we know yet what the Army-Navy game will look like. John and Ward can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that both schools are still holding out hope that at the very least the students will be able to attend, the midshipmen and the cadets. And then I think there is still some sliver of hope that some amount of crowd will be able to attend the game, which is scheduled to be in Philadelphia. Aside from being a huge rivalry game, it's normally a big moneymaker for the city of Philadelphia and a big moneymaker for each of the academies. So everybody, I think, has their fingers crossed that they'll at least be, it'll have, some semblance of what it's been like in years past. In terms of being in, at a football game, in the new normal, Ward is part of the chain gang, as they say. So he's on the sideline. His storied class of 82 has volunteered and has that responsibility of helping out during the game. So he has a perspective on the field. And then John and I were lucky enough as part of the podcast to be up in the press box for the game that was Navy's home opener over Labor Day. And it is very odd. The silence is deafening, as they say. And so, for those that are West Point graduates or Army fans, they have at least been able to have some amount of the Corps of Cadets, as well as some fans in the stand when they played their games up at West Point. And so it's been less odd, but it's still a very different experience than what folks are used to when they've gone to college football games.
Ward, you've had now more than 40 years of Navy football under your belt. What's it like being on the sidelines of, going to these games under these circumstances?
Well, it's weird. Like Chris said, the silence is deafening. So we didn't know quite what would happen for that first game. Obviously, Navy got hammered by BYU. A lot of lessons learned. They got their act together in the second game, the second half of the second game. And so we'll see what shows up on Saturday. But one of the fun parts, I've been doing it. This is now my sixth season of doing the chain gang. As Chris mentioned, my class has been doing it for near on 15 years. And so when I returned to Annapolis as a resident, I wound up being asked to be on the Chain Gang, I said sure, and not knowing quite what I was getting into. But my tenure has been all an upside in terms of the way that Navy football under Coach Niumatalolo has performed, you know, starting with the Keenan Reynolds amazing year in 2015, and most lately Malcolm Perry last year. So home games have been great. The fans have been, you know, really plugged in. The ambient noise on the sidelines gives you chills. There have been some real barn burners and nail biters. I think particularly about the game against Houston in 2015. We beat Memphis last year. We have beat Air Force twice at home in recent years. One was a very rainy day, a high drama game. So the absence of that is a lot in terms of the atmospherics. The players and the coaches would say they don't care, but I can't believe that's quite true. I think it is an intangible. But right now the state of Maryland, and this ruling has been made for the next home game against Temple a week from Saturday, that there will be no fans in the stands, including no members of the brigade. Right. So with respect to the Army-Navy game, I think that's going to be up to the city of Philadelphia and the state of Pennsylvania. Because certainly if they allow it, both the Corps of Cadets and the Brigade of Midshipmen will take busloads of their you know, constituencies, their student bodies, up there to attend the game. Now, whether fans will be allowed, I don't know. It's a different matter. But so far, it looks like the game is going to be played. That was in doubt at some point because the city of Philadelphia has eliminated all public events except the Eagles and the Army-Navy game were grandfathered in. So, yeah, it's a weird year, right? There is some noise. They pipe in ambient crowd noise, but it's not as sophisticated as what you see at NFL games in terms of the sound files, like touchdown, you know, you push a button on the keyboard. This is just sort of like, I know you're a big music fan, so if you think of the beginning of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, right, before the music starts, that's what it sounds like. Just this dull roar of crowds making their way into the theater. You know, no highs, no lows. That's just the noise that they've piped in. So it's actually, it adds to the weirdness to just have that as a backdrop. And so, you know, here's hoping we get back to some semblance of normal sooner rather than later, because falls, as a resident of Annapolis, are punctuated by home game weekends, tailgaters, you know, goings on downtown, and not to mention me being on the sidelines. And it's fun to be on the sidelines when the stands are full. You know,
that's right. So you can get envious glances from people. There's Ward again, right on the sidelines.
Yeah, no, it's my entire persona. You know, I've built a whole brand around being on the Chain Gang, which the AAC is not too happy about.
I can imagine. you're just not only a Navy to the Corps Ward, you're a legendary naval aviator as well. So I know that this is somewhat problematic. And speaking of dull roar, what's as objectively as you possibly can, and I must call on everybody to be objective about this, what's the United States Air Force Academy done that's raising military football eyebrows?
So we've had conversations in recent years based on the fact that Keenan Reynolds was given a waiver in terms of his military obligation to go play with the Ravens and then a few other teams until he was part of the XFL. Secretary Mabus waived his military obligation more or less, right? And most recently, Malcolm Perry had the same, under a new kind of regulation that the Trump administration came up with, was allowed to not have any military obligation in lieu of his attempting a football career. And he's already been more successful than Keenan was in that he actually made the 53-man roster of the Miami Dolphins. Keenan was always on the practice squads of the NFL teams he was on, and then he was a member of, I can't remember what XFL team was on, Orlando or something. That's onesies and twosies, right? You attend the United States Naval Academy or the Air Force Academy or West Point to be a line officer in each of those branches of service. That's why they exist. John Schofield could tell you what the value is of that education. I know it's in the hundreds of thousands, if not low millions of dollars. And everybody who walks in the front door has a session bogey at the end, right? So,
right.
You know, the numbers aren't random. So we've got submarines with your names on them. We got ships. We got platoons of Marines waiting to be led. We have airplanes. So, you know, like we say, we hire all of our graduates. That's why you matriculate. That's what the training's all about. This is what's supposed to be a differentiator between an NROTC unit and a service academy, right? So the Air Force Academy this year, the Turnback program has allowed 40 members of the football team to basically redshirt for a year with the idea that the season was going to be canceled. So they wanted to preserve their NCAA eligibility for another year, right?
Right.
And in essence, what this does, it is going to add a year to their undergraduate matriculation at the Air Force Academy. In the face of that, that is literally going to cost the taxpayer tens of millions of dollars. I don't see how this passes any kind of sniff check with respect to the focus on Division I football against the need to create future Air Force officers. It's beyond any reasonable explanation to my eye. I think the logic behind Malcolm and Keenan is already suspect in some camps. I mean, you can find some zealots in you know, Academy Facebook alum pages. They're like, why are we doing this? Why do we care? How come,
right.
You know, dot, 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 right? But now you take that times 40, and I think you've got something that's out of control with respect to the intent and the mission of a service academy.
Yeah, Baga. So following up on what Ward said, yeah, I did see a bunch of this as the PAO there at the Naval Academy. And I bring a unique perspective. As many people probably know, I did attend West Point for my plebe year, half of my plebe year before they told me to leave. So I've got a perspective from both the Naval Academy side and the ROTC side, having then matriculated at Villanova and done ROTC, that the understanding is that, you know, like Chris was saying, the difference between a service academy and ROTC is that the service academy, because of all the costs incurred, and Ward talked about the cost of educating a Mark I Mod 0 Naval Academy midshipman, and in the end, the cost of the education or the value is somewhere between $260,000 and $300,000, which doesn't really even account for salaries of teachers or professors who are teaching them. That's really just the number they have to pay back if they get kicked out in the end. Hey, the cost of the government for you to do this for 4 years but not become an officer is somewhere around between 260 and 300K. So with that in mind, you know that it's a four-year gig, that you know you don't have extra time, and they've made onesie, twosie exceptions. And the really big exception for a long time was just, you know, your Latter-day Saint mission, you know, Mormons who,
right.
You know, are told at the age of 19 that they go away for 2 years and preach the good word. And when they come back, their spot is waiting for them. What sports has now done is capitalized on that, on these loopholes, on these opportunities. And in the case of the Air Force Academy, just injected themselves in to take advantage of a really unique scenario. Fair or unfair, I don't know. But in this particular case, they are guilty of finding a loophole that I believe is wrong. And for all the reasons that Ward said, and talking to my friends who I have in the Army and Air Force, they all agree.
Chris, do you have a brief interjection on this before John wraps it up, talking about the game between Air Force and Navy that's coming up?
I do. I mean, I would just say that, you know, whether it's quarterbacks at Navy going to the pros, or whether it's turnbacks at the Air Force Academy, or whether it's, you know, the West Point has had a few players go directly to the pros as well. I think that the service academies are always going to be under intense scrutiny, and rightfully so, to make sure that the taxpayer is getting the max value for the amount of money that they're paying. As we said, sports are a huge part of life at the academy. Whether you're a intramural warrior, whether you're a club sports player, or whether you play varsity sports, I think that any time that you push the limits, which appears to be the case here, and what people said happened with the Keenan Reynolds a few years ago. Anytime you push the limits, you really do run the risk of the taxpayer and folks on the Hill turning their head a little bit and upping the amount of scrutiny that will occur. So I hope that whatever Air Force did, I hope it was well socialized. I hope it's worth it in the end. And more importantly, I hope it doesn't cost the reputation and the opportunity that Service Academy Sports have been given to play the unique role that they do in the life of cadets and midshipmen.
Right. All of this is exacerbated against the backdrop of sort of COVID, but also, right, concerns about flat defense spending. And you know, it's always... it heightens attention and interest in military matters when stuff like this spills over, as Ward rightly said, right? I mean, the mission of the schools is to produce the future leaders of each of the military services. John, bring it home. Conversation has been great, but gone on maybe a little bit longer than we'd originally hoped because the content was very rich. Talk to us a little bit about the game that's coming up between the United States Air Force Academy and the Naval Academy.
Absolutely. So we at Sling Second Sports have been looking at this for a while now, and the game is Saturday at 6 p.m., so it should be a good primetime viewing experience for everyone. The big thing we're looking at, number one, is PAOs. We're always into style. So the Air Force uniforms, I think, are awesome. We talked about it on our pod this week. A salute or homage, as it were, to the Tuskegee Airmen, with a really cool red tail themed uniform from the Air Force Academy. So I'm balancing out my negative comments to them earlier with some positive comments about their uniform. And then the other thing we're looking at is, this is their first game coming out and doing what we did with BYU during Labor Day weekend. So they're doing it without a majority of their starters on defense, who were the recipients of this fun little turnback thing we were just talking about. So first game for them, a lot of people missing. I think we're looking at possibly a really low scoring, ugly game, because remember, Navy only looked good for about a half of a game last week against Tulane, or 2 weeks ago against Tulane. So It could be really low scoring and ugly, or it could be a really high scoring affair with Navy kind of putting the hurt on the Air Force Academy. We'll see. But I think it'll be entertaining nonetheless, just because anytime two service academies play, it's a great deal.
Gentlemen, thanks very, very much. Ward, keep serving the side well on the sidelines. Hopefully we can resume coming to games so that we can appropriately harass you. Chris, thanks very much. Looking to having you back on tomorrow. And John, always a pleasure having you guys on. Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thanks, Fargo.
Thanks, Fargo.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.